difficult to keep the line between the past and the present.
Do you believe that someone out of the past can enter and take possession of a living being?
We may be through with the past, but the past is not through with us.
Welcome back to The Next Picture Show, a Movie of the Week podcast devoted to a classic film and the way it shaped our thoughts on a recent release. I'm Keith Phipps, here with
Genevieve Kosky,
Scott Tobias,
and Tasha Robinson.
On last week's episode, we talked about Adaptation, a Charlie Kaufman scripted, Spike Jones directed film starring Nicolas Cage as a fictionalized version of Charlie Kaufman and a wholly fictionalized version of his brother Donald. It's an exploration of the themes of its ostensible source material, Susan Orlean's The Orchid Thief, and a reflection on the process of creation and Hollywood expectations. There's a lot of Adaptation DNA in The Unbearable Weight of Massive Talent, as we'll no doubt cover in our discussion, but its meta energy is focused on the persona, on screen and off, of star Nicolas Cage. Directed by Tom Gormican and written by Gormican and Kevin Etten, the film began as an experiment. After working together on the one-season comedy Ghosted, the two paired to write a screenplay to prove they could write screenplays, whether or not the film ever got made, or Cage agreed to star in it. Cage initially said no, and it's not hard to see why. The Nick Cage of the film has reached the apparent bottom of a long slump. Desperate to break out of it, he practically begs for roles. He's estranged from his ex-wife, played by Sharon Horgan, and on not great terms with his teenage daughter, played by Lily Sheen. And echoing Cage's own well-documented financial troubles, he needs money, badly enough to say yes to a personal appearance at the home of a wealthy superfan named Javi, played by Pedro Pascal. It's at Javi's estate that he discovers he's in over his head, but his troubles predate his arrival. He's tormented by a younger version of himself who's disappointed that he's no longer the No Limits Wild Man he used to be. It's also easy to see why Cage eventually said yes to doing the movie. It's a clever, deeply affectionate film that takes its title seriously. Nick Cage is a comic character, but he's also a gifted actor. And the Nicolas Cage who plays him makes this clear, turning Nick into a soulful, three-dimensional character trying to make peace with his past work, his downturn, his shortcomings, and the expectations of others. It can be goofy, but the film's not a goof. It takes Cage and viewers' own associations and attachment to the star 4 decades into his career seriously. Or at least as seriously as a movie in which Nicolas Cage makes out with himself can. We'll be right back after the break.
What's the worry here, Nick? You've lost some of your talent as an actor?
No.
What did he say?
He says he loves you, but he went in a different direction.
I'm done. I'm quitting acting. Tell the trades it was a tremendous honor to be a part of storytelling and mythmaking.
Ah, fuck, man, I'm driving through the hills. I'm sorry, one more time.
We got another offer. It's $1 million. It's to attend a wealthy gentleman's birthday party.
I would never do that.
It's the easiest gig ever. You play yourself.
Welcome to Mallorca, Mr. Cage.
The guy that owns this house, what's his name?
Javi.
Is Javi gonna want me to,
play him, Javi.
Nick Cage.
God, this place is stunning.
What is your favorite movie?
That's one of those questions that's impossible to answer. You can't just limit it to one.
Imagine me and you, I do.
Is it too much?
Is this supposed to be me? It's grotesque. I'll give you $20,000 for it.
All right, so let's talk about The Unbearable Weight of Massive Talent, a film I've tipped my hand. I enjoyed this film. What about everybody else?
With reservations. The way I think about it, actually, is it is a Charlie Kaufman film as Donald Kaufman might write it. You know what I mean? It's just it's just good enough to make you wish that it were better, but it is still pretty good. I'll leave it at that for now.
I enjoyed it. I enjoyed it a lot, actually, while I was watching it and immediately after. Although I will say it's been a week since I went to a screening of this film, and not a whole lot of it has stuck with me. I think probably like the strongest memory I have of it at this point is just the scenes with Nicolas Cage and Pedro Pascal and sort of like the weird energy they bring out in each other, especially that Cage brings out in Pedro Pascal, who I've never really seen him in this mode. So it was kind of fun to see sort of the shift in performance that Nick Cage perhaps brought out in him. The sort of the central gag, the conceit of the movie, like, you know, it's smart, it's clever, and I don't think like it loses that cleverness as it, like in how it incorporates that, but I think it just like becomes less surprising and as the film progresses, and it feels maybe a little bit like as the film progresses, it's struggling a little more to make that cleverness as pronounced as it feels at the beginning, and maybe gets a little sweaty about it.
Yeah, I thought this film was entirely okay. I really think that Pedro Pascal is an underappreciated comedic talent who, based on this film, should definitely be doing more comedic roles. No knock against his dramatic roles. I think he's just a really good and talented actor. But as Genevieve says, like, I haven't seen him in this mode before. And it was really pleasing to see him in this mode. I feel like I've seen Nick Cage in all of these roles, in all of these modes before. And as with so many, you know, kind of mediocre to okay films, his verve and like commitment to bits can kind of enliven films that otherwise maybe don't entirely work. But this film feels to me like somebody's trying to emulate the Charlie Kaufman formula without having like any of the genius behind it, you know, any of the commitment to the bit, as it were. And I think maybe nothing in the film underlines that more for me than the presence of Nicky Cage, the reverse age Nicolas Cage that kind of lives in his head, who is an entertaining and definitely weird presence, but one that just doesn't really have any thematic weight or any recurring content that would make it understandable what he's doing in this film, besides giving it kind of an extra bit of zazz. I just don't know why he has this character living in his head, what causes the character to come out when he does. It kind of feels like, all right, we haven't seen Nicky this act. It's time for Nicky's second act appearance. Now it's time for Nicky's third act appearance. It all just feels very mechanical. And that's how I felt about a lot of the screenplay here.
I do wonder how Nicky plays to someone who has just immersed themselves in Nicolas Cage's filmography for over a year, and if he carries more thematic weight in the context of someone deeply familiar with the progression of Nick Cage's career.
I'll let Scott take this one. Yeah, a little bit. His appearance, down to his Wild at Heart t-shirt, is a very specific reference to a talk show appearance he made in the UK on a show called Wogan, which is either he comes out, does karate kicks, takes his shirt off, it's either someone losing his mind on television or a pretty inspired piece of performance art or some combination of the two. It is on YouTube. Just Google, look for Nicolas Cage Wogan, W-O-G-A-N, and take the 5 minutes to watch it. It's really quite an incredible thing. But I think that, you know, Etten and Gormican did their homework. You know, Nicolas Cage began his career with, you know, first he didn't do interviews, and then he would talk about being uncomfortable with Hollywood projects because he wanted to bring kind of a punk energy to what he did. He's someone who immediately after making Moonstruck went and made Vampire's Kiss. He felt like that was too conventional of a film. He needed to go and swerve in the opposite direction. So this is definitely someone who early in his career was deeply invested in the image of himself as a rebellious wild man. You know, I have no great insights into Nicolas Cage's psyche, but he's older now. And if you read interviews with him, he's a lot more reflective. And I think that, you know, I don't think the Nicolas Cage we see in this film is the real Nicolas Cage. But I think there are elements of having grown up and grown past that wild man phase while still being haunted both by the person he used to be and also the fact that the person he used to be has been immortalized on, you know, on screen And it's still kind of the locked in default image that some people have of you, despite growing older and amassing a body of work and amassing a lot of life experience that have moved past that phase of your life. I think it works. I'm sure it's every appearance of Nikki is comic gold, but I do like those moments.
The Nikki character should have been named Miles Lovecraft, right?
Yes. Cage's proposed alter ego, Miles Lovecraft. I think that Lovecraft. Might have been too deep cut of a reference for the target audience of this film.
Though I will say a couple of things to this film's favor. One is that it actually really does dig into Cage Arcana. It's not just the obvious stuff, which I appreciate. I appreciate just that we open with this conversation he's having with David Gordon Green, who is not identified as David Gordon Green, who you would have to know directed Cage and Joe, right? Again, not mentioned, but kind of great that he's in the movie. And you know, if you know Cage's work, you can kind of bring that, and know Gordon Green's work, you can bring that to the table. And then you also have payoffs like one of my favorite moments of the movie where Pedro Pascal is excited because he knows from the making of featurette on the Gone in 60 Seconds DVD that Cage could drive this car really fast. So I thought that was pretty great.
Having watched that same featurette as part of my research, yes, I appreciate that joke too.
Oh my God, that's you dug deep, Keith. You dug deep.
Well, speaking of digging deep, like, Keith, I'm just very curious how this movie plays to somebody who's watched all of the Cage movies recently, in that it's so referential. Like, there's enough stuff that I caught that I started to feel like there's probably like 10 times as many things I didn't catch. And when I was sort of reading up a little bit on some of the reaction to the film, there were things like the moment where he takes a beer and like walks into the pool, and Pedro Pascal pulls him up out of the pool, is like a shot reference to Leaving Las Vegas, which I wouldn't have remembered because I saw Leaving Las Vegas when it came out and haven't seen it since. Uh-huh. I'm just wondering if you ended up feeling like the whole movie is full of moments like that, that people aren't going to get unless they're deeply steeped in Nick Cage movies, like on a shot for shot basis.
Yeah, I mean, they're in there. I think that's really one of the subtler ones there. I don't think it's that subtle because it is a fairly well-known shot, perhaps if you haven't seen it in 20 plus years, maybe not as familiar. But I mean, I think the Wogan thing is a really deep cut. I think most of the other cuts are fairly, you don't have to have written a book about Nicolas Cage to get all of them, I don't think. Although, who knows? I probably missed references myself as well. I do like
that. And there's some like non-film meme references, like the sequin pillow, sequin face pillow, and so which makes its appearance in the sort of Cage shrine vault.
And I feel like the pillows, having looked at, you know, Cage paraphernalia, I think that pillow and variations of it is probably the most grotesque example. So it was a really good choice to kind of stand in for that whole, you know, unofficial merchandise world of Cageana. Mm-hmm.
That sequin pillow would be fine if it didn't turn into like Nick Cage with huge bloody wounds across his face when you swipe it the wrong way. Like, the fact that the sequins are all red on the other side, and like any disruption of them lying with their nap in the right direction just produces like blood red splotches, is that's pretty disturbing.
I will say though I think one of the crucial saving graces of this movie is that it does respect Cage so much, like, you know, as an artist, you know, as somebody who is really struggling in a sincere, you know, way to challenge himself, to remain relevant, to be passionate about what he's doing, to need all these things, to have this true artistic spirit. It doesn't take any of that as a joke, because I think there's a way of understanding Cage as a joke, and it can be uncomfortable to watch sometimes. I mean, there was even during Keith's screening double feature at the Music Box, there were some moments during Face Off where it's just like, what? Stop laughing right now, people. It's like you know, you're just like, you're laughing at the wrong stuff. You know, there's a lot of stuff that you should be laughing at, but you're not like, this is Nicolas Cage himself is not a joke. He's a serious actor who also, you know, is willing to go far on a limb comedically and dramatically, and just give you something large and sometimes silly and audacious and funny. But ultimately, this is a real actor, and I think that's kind of an important thing for this movie to get right, because I think it could easily have been entirely a put on, entirely a joke, and it's not.
Yeah, that's what I was afraid it was going to be. And I think that it's actually walks that line really well, where it makes, you know, it definitely has jokes in there about his financial troubles and spending habits and the fact that he's, you know, not starring in A-list films anymore. But it does take him seriously. And I think, again, I think they did their research, whereas I think that Cage squares with the Cage that you read interviews with and as he presents himself. I mean, who knows who I have no idea who he is behind closed doors, but I do, you know, he talks about being, you know, he talks very seriously about acting, and I think he's got the career to back it up. And, you know, having watched the last decade of Cage's work, I mean, there are some gems in there. There's some really, you know, some good films that perhaps got a little overlooked. There are films that aren't good at all. And there are some near misses and ambition that doesn't quite come together and work with an interesting director like Paul Schrader and Larry Charles. It doesn't quite gel, but he's giving it his all. I mean, there's a serious commitment to whatever he does. You know, I think this film gets that about him. And I think that's a large part of why it works. And I think in some ways, I feel like it's kind of perhaps a way for him to, you know, be in on the joke while giving it a punchline. I mean, this film in some ways, I kind of hope is sort of the end of the meme Cage and the joke Cage and the reflexive, you know, chuckles that his name raises thanks to like supercuts and of the big moments, his performances and things like that. Who knows?
Oh, I mean, I definitely don't think this is going to be the end of anything. I mean, yeah, like he has to live with that library, you know, the library of performances. That's what people know him for. I don't know why this would put paid to anything. Well, I don't think it's definitive enough.
Always know the performances. They know the moments that turn up in, like, you know, from The Wicker Man and Xanderly and things like that, that turn up in Supercuts. And a lot of those, okay, not Xanderly, but a lot of those moments play much better and much different in context.
Not The Wicker Man, though.
Not The Wicker Man, no. Okay, fine.
Let me ask you this question, Keith, because mm-hmm. you have been to Cage places that nobody else has been. that commitment you talk about, the seriousness of Cage, the effort that he brings to his movies, does that extend to the films that he has made in, say, Romania?
Yeah, I mean, yes, it does. I mean, there are a couple of performances in films like Left Behind. There's a film called Rage, which I think is a real low point for him. There's a couple other of VOD things, specifically VOD things from the beginning of his ventures into that sphere of filmmaking, where he feels a little less fully present. But we're really talking about a couple of films, and the rest of the time, I mean, he's there. Part of what made me want to do the book as kind of a, like, well, let's see if this is actually worth pursuing. I pulled a couple of random later, like mid 2016 films that you would get at Redbox off the shelf and give them a look. And they weren't good, but he is good in them. I mean, he is really giving it his all, fully invested in the character, doing some interesting things, you know, elevating the material as much as one person can.
I do think it's also in terms of sort of, you know, whether this will, as Keith hopes, sort of like put to bed a certain perception or era of our Cage appreciation. I do think it's important to note that like this, like the happy ending of this movie is a movie. It's this movie, you know, like it spends the whole movie kind of doing this sort of fun, weird, like Nicolas Cage digression, but then in the end it comes back down to a movie, a good movie that people like, you know. And I think sort of where we are in Cage's career, like it's interesting to me that this comes on the heels of Pig, which I think is probably the most rapturous response he's gotten in a while, you know. And obviously it's not incorporated here by virtue of timing, and I don't know, it probably wouldn't fit.
It's
a reference.
It kind of spoils the narrative, doesn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Like, I feel like we are maybe, we have already moved past that stage, and this kind of maybe feels like a remnant of it. But I don't know, maybe that's just influenced by the fact that my very good friend put out a book about Nicolas Cage's career recently and coupled with Pig. But I don't know, what am I being over generous?
I just feel like this movie, I feel like it's sloppy in a lot of pretty key ways. And the fact that this Nick Cage, who's a fictional Nick Cage, shares all of Nick Cage's big hits and yet at the same time is a failure, even though the movie doesn't feel very placed in time, to me just kind of feels like something that the movie is not interested in addressing in any way. I don't think that Pig is being taken into consideration here, but I don't think that there's a philosophy behind it. It just doesn't fit the kind of ill-formed fiction that's going on here. Like, one of the things sort of walking into this movie that I kind of had problems with was like, okay, Nick Cage is Nick Cage. He's still the Nick Cage that made The Rock and Face Off. He's still internationally famous, but he can't get a role. He's considered a reject and he's miserable. And also he's surrounded by extremely recognizable movie stars, none of whom are actually playing themselves. I'm very glad that I did not revisit Adaptation before seeing this movie, because I think Adaptation's, like, the quality at which it goes into some of these questions of like symbolism and parallelism just highlights the degree to which Unbearable Weight of Massive Talent feels a little unfinished and unformed.
Yeah, but it seems just a couple drafts away, right?
Yeah, exactly. I just like a couple drafts and a couple concepts in terms of how did Nick Cage get to be 98% of the Nick Cage we know and yet still be, you know, in debt, miserable, and unable to get a job. That's sort of a thing that I struggled with. And then Neil Patrick Harris walking in, and he's not Neil Patrick Harris. At that point, you're like, okay, what is the fiction of this movie exactly?
I can't speak to the miserable aspect of it, but he was apparently still in debt as until a year and a half or so ago. And in terms of getting roles, I mean, he really was taking the roles he could. It's particularly when, you know, he felt the need to work at a pace that would, you know, pay off some of that debt. But also he's someone who talks in interviews about not being comfortable not working. So, you know, if you want to keep working, you're just going to move from one project to another, and that's what you have. So I you know, he's not broke and living in what they're not calling the Chateau Marmont, but clearly is a Chateau Marmont. But you know, it's not light years away from his situation in some ways.
What's kind of fascinating about him is he's kind of a lead actor who has the mentality of a character actor.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, the idea of making movies as a job, as mm-hmm. something where you just go from gig to gig to gig, that's not star talk. That's not lead actor talk. And Nick Cage is the lead actor in movies. He's not a supporting player much of the time. He has to be front and center.
Yeah, right. Very rare exception. Yeah.
And so it becomes a philosophical sort of quandary then about how does he stay a star, you know, because character actors don't have to worry about that.
Well, and far be it for me to like tell a movie how to be a movie, but I did go back to the criticism of like, you know, maybe this needed a few more drafts. I was reading an interview with Cage in the Hollywood Reporter where he notes that originally they were initially talking about that Nikki character being like Cameron Poe from Con Air instead of this, you know, Wogan Wild at Heart era Cage. And as far as like sort of the dissonance Tasha is talking about of like this huge star Cage, how he fits in this world, I almost think that making that second Cage a personification of that movie star Cage and letting the real, the Nick of this movie represent the more tortured artist or character actor, better yet, might have made that tension a little more clear. I don't know.
I think maybe stronger than that would have been if there were just a bunch of different versions of him, because mm-hmm. there are so many versions of actual Nick Cage that we know. Like, he's kind of famous for, there's the like serious actor artist who showed up for Pig and Leaving Las Vegas. There's, you know, the over the top, like frothy mouthed wild man of Mom and Dad that people love to see show up. There's like the wonky dude who will be in anything. There's the, you know, the Wild at Heart era, kind of like swaggering, hip shaking, like young buck raring to go. There's the tortured artist we're talking about. Like, I don't know that the movie would have been improved by him being followed around by like a cloud of 10 Nick Cages, but I could easily see it being like a triumvirate of three that show up at different times that have different motives for him and different desires for him. And that being an element of him being pulled in different directions, which I don't know if Nick Cage processes it that way, but a lot of the people that have watched him throughout his career see his career as being pulled between these different poles and these different personas. And many of them have a favorite. And I think maybe giving them personas and arguments to be made about why they're the important Nick Cage might have given this more depth than it has and made the Nicky character more than just kind of a one trick pony with a single thing to contribute.
I don't think necessarily it's such a good idea to have more versions of that character. I mean, I think it's reasonably effective, this device, not wholly effective, but reasonably effective to have this reminder of his youth and the wildness of his youth and that original, you know, impulse to be a certain type of unbridled actor. And there's a tension, a productive tension between that kind of youthful soul that is still, you know, it's still sort of is restless and within him and the older version of himself, the one who's been through a lot, who can't be that guy anymore. But he's still hearing that guy. I think it makes sense that it's just a conversation between those two people rather than multiple versions of Cage.
I can almost feel the desire to move on to Connections just because there's so much to talk about between these two movies. Much as we kind of like wrapped up last time with like, yeah, but let's talk about the rest of the cast. I definitely feel like we should take in the non-Cage elements of the cast here. And one of my feelings there that just kind of circles back to that feeling of this feels like a first draft that needed two more drafts is the way Ike Barinholtz and Tiffany Haddish are used in this movie.
Mm. Yeah.
It really feels to me like this movie got edited pretty sharply at some points in just with the mentality being, let's get to the action quicker at the expense of developing some fairly important plot points, like the cut from the three of them in the van to Nick Cage off on like a heist adventure felt like, you know, a scene missing card to me. And yeah, Tiffany Haddish's disappearance from the film at the end, I also just found.
Well, and Ike Barinholtz's.
Ike Barinholtz's character, I think, had pretty clearly been killed.
Killed, yeah.
Like, he's the way he's sprawled bonelessly in that chair, I'm fairly sure he was dead.
100%.
Tiffany Haddish took a bullet in the shoulder, which is exactly what happened to Pedro Pascal. There's no reason that she would have died, but the film is completely uninterested in her. You know, it just,
yeah,
it,
I mean,
discards,
I guess
her.
I just processed it as she also died, which is why I loved them together, because it doesn't. Yeah.
They're funny people who are underutilized here, clearly.
But Pedro Pascal, man,
terrific.
He was utilized very, very well.
Yeah, I think Tiffany Haddish and Ike Barinholtz are both used very, very well. They just feel like they got half their scenes cut out of the film.
That's kind of what I mean. But yeah, but with Pascal, like the nice thing is like you could almost take away the Nicolas Cage-ness of it and have a buddy movie with those two. In fact, you know, I would not object to them pairing again. Yeah. They're really fun together.
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
Their LSD trip, the wall gag, like it was very obvious, but I think they sold it.
There is that moment when they're together, when they're talking animatedly about their screenplay, where they decide, you know, you can't just have a movie with two guys being comedic together. Like, everybody wants a plot, where I just found myself thinking, all right, I see what you're doing here. Thank you, Meta Movie. But maybe we could just have two guys being funny together, because I don't care about your presidential election heist plot. I care about watching these two actors be entertaining together. It was by far the best part of the movie. And it felt like we moved on from it too quickly in the effort to Donald Kaufman it up and, you know,
get back to the exercise of
car chases and gun plays.
Yeah, I mean, that stuff's fine. It's whatever. But the third act, you know, the thing you can't take away from the third act is the gag with him and heavy makeup and that whole sequence, which made me laugh. I think it's Sharon Horgan's best moment in the movie too, and that's funny stuff.
Yeah, I liked her.
She was, yeah, she's entertaining, and she gets some really good action. I really object to the way that entire plot line was set up in terms of, yeah, we're just going to hand wave everything away about how in the world any of this makes sense, because we know you just want to see him in the goofy makeup doing the goofy role, which I did. It was fun, but it makes not a lick of sense.
Hey, you know what? You know what just occurred to me, really, because I talked about this being kind of a Donald Kaufman, you know, a version of a Charlie Kaufman script written by Donald Kaufman. This is actually Donald Kaufman somewhere. Like, because you have Cage, you know, what is he? He's in the Chateau Marmont or something like that, right? At the beginning of the movie. Mm-hmm. Just like Stephen Dorff, you know, he's in this kind of existential stupor, but, you know, of the sort that Charlie Kaufman would feel perfectly happy marinating in, but Donald Kaufman would not. Donald Kaufman would have to imagine this version. He would have to blow out that story and would have to throw him into, you know, Majorca with this super spy story. So, you know, this meta super spy story. So it feels kind of maybe like that. Somewhere would have been an interesting pairing with this movie as well.
Do we need to go back and re-record the whole first part of this podcast?
No, we do not. Yeah, well, listeners should know that we record these back to back. The illusion of a week passing is just that's showbiz magic.
Trickery.
Yeah.
Scott,
us acknowledging it is very meta. Right?
Yeah, if you're gonna let them in on the behind the scenes thing, like at least do it symbolically with characters and like complicated screenplay things. Don't just come out and flat tell them.
Yeah, this all seems to me like a good point at which to move on. Yay. To connections. So we will do that and talk about Adaptation and The Unbearable Weight of Massive Talent after the break.
Thank you. Can you just stop stalling and answer the question? What is your third favorite movie of all time?
Paddington 2.
What? Cabinet of Dr. Caligari, Paddington 2. Connect those dots. I mean, I don't want to be a snob, but...
I cried through the entire thing and made me want to be a better man.
Now it's time for connections, when you bring these two films together and talk about all the things they have in common. Well, I guess maybe the most obvious one is Nicolas Cage as two characters. Although, you know, the duality is a lot more central in Adaptation to than it is in Unbearable Weight. But let's talk about that. What, you know, we're getting four Cages across two films. What's the effect of that?
It's great. I love seeing Olympics Cage.
It certainly lets him stretch. You know, it's certainly that kind of multiplicity that I was talking about earlier has been just such a consistent element throughout his career. So like seeing him in one film play a self-hating, awkward, nebbish, and an outgoing, like cheerful, popular, upbeat guy, seeing him in another movie playing like a downcast older guy who's feels his career is at an end, and like an upbeat, probably coked up kid who's high on his own farts. Like there's an element of fun in that, you know, in watching him play two radically different people playing entirely opposite each other. He's such a big presence in so many films, it takes a pretty big presence to keep up with him. And just making that other presence also Nick Cage, I think is maybe just a quality idea in and of itself.
One of the things I like about the duality and Adaptation specifically is that Charlie and Donald, like they are very, very different, but they are not really opposites. Tasha, you just talked about how Donald was like, you know, outgoing and popular and everything. And like, Yeah, by comparison, but he does still have this sort of innate sadness to him. And that is and it's really all there in Cage's performance and how he portrays him. Like the first time we meet Donald, he's lying on the floor, you know, in the house he's squatting in. And, you know, he comes across as nice and sweet, but also like not a particularly charismatic person, you know. And again, the degree to which he is any of those things is strictly in relationship to Charlie. So it's really like I think a really delicate like amplification of certain traits in each character, whereas in Unbearable Weight, like it's just like those characters are not really related to each other other than the fact that they are both supposedly the same person, but like the performances are just, you know, there's no real common thread to the performances other than that they are both supposed to be Nick Cage.
I think there is one common thread, which is ego. I think that all four of these Cages are connected with a string of ego. And that's sort of part of the theme there. You know, the fact that the only people that can keep up with them is them. The only people that are worth reflecting themselves back at themselves is them. With Unbearable Weight, it just kind of feels like he has conversations with his younger self that he can't have with anybody else about his inadequacies and his hopes. In Adaptation, it sort of feels like Charlie dumps on anybody that comes near him, but he dumps most on Donald because Donald's closest to him. And Donald entrusts Charlie with all sorts of things because he looks up to him. In both cases, there just seems to be this sense that even if they're very different personalities, even if they're expressing their needs and their desires in very different ways because they're very different needs and desires, there's still like the narcissism that Scott was talking about in part one, I think is there. I think anytime you have a character playing kind of two aspects of themselves, talking to themselves about themselves, there's an inherent reflection of narcissism that's very deliberate in both cases. And I think that there's nothing wrong with it, but I think it is sort of an exploration of like the inner life of a single person in both movies.
In both films, so these are not flattering depictions. Like Charlie Kaufman is very hard on himself and not all that, you know, whatever we think of Donald in relation to him, that's not in some ways it's a not always the most attractive character either. We also get the same thing with Nicolas Cage here, playing the modern Nicolas Cage as someone who's seen better days and has some deep flaws as a person, primarily self-involvement that's made him neglect his family. And the younger self is just kind of an overbearing weirdo and egomaniac as well. I guess, you know, it's kind of the opposite of a Mary Sue here. So what's going on with all these sort of this self-loathing on screen in both these films?
I don't think the self-loathing doesn't really exist in the characters of Donald and of Nicky, right? Those are entirely with Charlie. And
it's not part of their personalities, but they're also like, you know, these aren't the most attractive creations either.
No. Well, I mean, that was the thing too with Adaptation, you know, as with being John Malkovich, the actors themselves, these glamorous people, your John Cusacks, your Cameron Diaz's, and Nick Cage are rendered very unflatteringly on screen, and there's nothing, you know, in terms of their wardrobe and their hair and makeup and all other stuff is you know, all of that movie star vanity, those movie star qualities are sort of stripped away. That's not really true of the Nick Cage in Unbearable Weight, though there is that self-loathing, there is that sense of desperation that's present in that character. Then Nick Cage is still at his age, you know, he still has extraordinary presence in a way that the Nick, you know, Charlie Kaufman in Adaptation does not.
While we're talking about unflattering depictions, is this where we note the de-aging effects in Unbearable Weight? How did that land for it?
It's medium budget.
Yeah. That's kind of a thing. That's kind of the medium budgetness of Unbearable Weight is definitely a big negative. You know, not just in that technology, which is really hard to pull off on a large budget, but the not entirely metafictional second-rateness of the production kind of hits you a little bit, because it does seem to exist. The action in Unbearable Weight maybe tries to suggest blockbuster Nicolas Cage, but in fact, maybe better reflects shot in Romania Nicolas Cage instead.
This was shot in Croatia. Pardon me.
Oh, was it? Oh, actually, was shot in Croatia.
It was shot in Croatia. Croatia is subbing in for Spain.
I mean, it looks. I've heard great. I mean, Croatia.
It looks
incredible.
Lovely. Yeah,
it really does. And I've heard very nice things about people who have, you know, about anyway. Well, I don't know what the
Croatian Croatian listeners. We love you.
Yeah, no, it's great. Your country. Yeah, very beautiful Croatian listeners.
So to return to the connection,
no,
the connection
no.
here,
Don't
I mean, well, we've, you know, talking about sort of unflattering depictions of these characters, like I think we've been kind of dwelling on the Cage part of that. But like in terms of adaptation, like it's Kaufman who is the character who is, you know, unflattering here. But I think like in adaptation, and maybe to a lesser extent in Unbearable Weight, like, the, I guess, redemption is in the existence of the movie itself. Like, the redemption for that character is in the movie we get, you know, and this, like, wonderful, you know, screenplay that crystallizes, and that we've seen him, like, quite literally slash metaphorically tear himself in two to make for us. The way, you know, in the end, it comes together, and it does sort of feel like this screenplay is a reflection of Charlie Kaufman, the person, and that is sort of the redemption of the way he's been portrayed throughout the movie. Does that make sense? It's very meta, I know, but I thought it would be appropriate here.
It's a meta touch to our discussion.
Well, it doesn't, and I think overall the connection to adaptation, you know, in Unbearable Weight just looks so thin, but by comparison, I mean, it's fascinating. The contrast between the two is fascinating because I think with adaptation, you have Donald and Charlie are two parts of the same person, and in an Unbearable Weight, it's two eras of the same person. So there's that interesting separation of time, but I don't think there's a huge amount of rigor invested in that Nicky side character at all. Really, he's just kind of, he's almost more like, you know, Humphrey Bogart in Played Against Sam, right? The Woody Allen film, the Herbert Ross film that was written and starring Woody Allen. I mean, it's kind of like that. It's just kind of, he's much more kind of a voice in his head than a fully realized conceit.
Yeah, I would go further and say that I don't see any evidence that there's any particular thought to Nicky's presence at all in this film. I think
there
could be, but I don't see it. It feels to me like, in some ways, it's an extended riff on adaptation, in the same way we're seeing riffs on various other films that he did throughout this movie. It feels like something that once they realized they could do as a kind of an adaptation reference or riff, they seized on the idea and liked it and expanded it, but just didn't really put any thought into why it was there or what it was accomplishing. It certainly highlights the character Nick Cage's feelings of inadequacy and concern, and the sense of like where he came from. But just in terms of the function that he plays in the story, he seems just like a random bonus that's a lot more fun than a lot of the third act in particular, but not very conceptual, not very integrated into the story, which is just a kind of a problem I had throughout.
Yeah, the other thing too, it's just I think because this is about Nick Cage and maybe about what we know about him, it's like I'm so much more interested in what he's thinking about himself as a creative being and his process and all of that stuff. I don't really care if he's neglected his family and his kid, and I mean, that kind of stuff is just not really all that resonant. I don't know how you all felt about that.
Well, there's also a question of whether it reflects anything that's actually real. Like one
even
of the,
if it does, I don't care. I just don't care.
One of the suggestions that for a pairing here, and boy, we were not short at all on pairing ideas, pairing possibilities for this, but Jean-Claude Van Damme's JCVD came up as one possible. And that feels like a film that is a lot more thoughtful and reflexive about a particular actor's place in Hollywood, like place in cinema and place in the world. I think that there are other, like even Being John Malkovich, which is in many ways a very silly movie where John Malkovich is playing quote unquote John Malkovich rather than an actual person. There's, I think, almost a sense more of like weight and reality of like what it would be like to be that person in that very silly film than there is here about who Nick Cage is. I don't know to what degree adaptation reflects Charlie Kaufman's like real actual feelings about himself. And I know that it does reflect an actual struggle with the screenplay for Orchid Thief, but I don't know how much of that kicking himself is real and how much of it is a performance to heighten the movie. But in the end, I feel like we come away at least feeling like we know Charlie Kaufman, the person, from adaptation a lot better than we feel like we come away knowing Nick Cage, the person, from Unbearable Weight.
Yeah, the family stuff is probably the most screenwriterly element to it, the most Donald Kaufman sort of element to it as well. And it doesn't really bear much resemblance to Cage's own private life insofar as I, you know, what's in the public record anyway.
The broad strokes are probably true, though, right? I mean, like the idea that he's, you know, that he's at, you know, an inflection point in his career. He's has debts. He has.
Oh, I just, you know, I meant specifically the family stuff. It doesn't really
not
line
in
up.
not its particulars, but you know, I think there's been a little bit of reported rockiness on that front. Yeah, obviously the debt problem is pretty real.
Right. Right.
But the song part, the birthday song part, that's all made up, right?
No, that's all taken directly from life.
You know, if the tension in the film is he's neglected his family because of his career, Cage actually turned down both the Matrix and
Lord of the Rings.
Lord of the
right?
Rings, right? In part because he did not want to leave his son behind. So there's that.
Oh, there you go. I feel like we would be shorting ourselves if we didn't at some point just address the fact that both of these movies are heavily structured around characters describing the mechanics of writing a screenplay, and the screenplay that they're describing is also the screenplay that we're seeing. You know, both of these movies are structured very specifically to have characters say, well, we need to do this by this point in the screenplay, and then the movie does exactly the thing they were describing. And I think it's done a lot better in adaptation. In Unbearable Weight, again, I feel like it's mostly there to copycat an earlier, better movie. But there is a certain humorous element to characters saying, all right, well, we've got to make sure there's no deus ex machina. And then, of course, there is one. Or, well, we've got to make sure that there's a big like third act emotional family twist. And then, of course, there's going to be one. Both of these movies are kind of the usual Hollywood examines what it's like to be in Hollywood stories. The boy, making movies sure is hard, isn't it? Like movie making. And both of them are kind of built entirely around the idea of what does it take to make a screenplay? Let's examine that while doing it at the exact same time.
I was never clear. Maybe I just wasn't paying attention, but like what was the state of Pedro Pascal's screenplay? I mean, because it feels like once they start collaborating, quote unquote, that it just almost feels like,
well, they threw out his screenplay,
yeah,
and started
they're starting
over
from scratch.
Okay, but that the process is just then to improvise a script that has no real where you don't know what it's going to do at all.
Well, they're talking through a script that they're going to write. It's kind of the classic writer instead of actually sitting down and doing the work of writing, as we see Charlie Kaufman banging his head against that process over and over. You sit and brainstorm with somebody, and the two of you convince each other of your genius. Like, oh, these are great ideas that we're having. We're not going to actually
LSD together.
Yeah, we're not actually going to do the rigorous part of writing stuff down. They're just spitballing throughout the whole movie, and then we're seeing the things that they spitball happen as a result of what they're spitballing, effectively.
And it does kind of feel reflective of just, I guess, the story of this movie getting made, where Tom Gormican and Kevin Etten like wrote a screenplay kind of to see if they could, you know, like it's a screenplay as challenge, you know. And I think the lack of sharpness in the movie is maybe reflective of that sort of that approach, that like, let's figure this out as we go along. Whereas in Adaptation, you know, it's specifically Charlie Kaufman following up being John Malkovich, you know, and doing a form that he, in writing a form of screenplay and adaptation that he hadn't done at that point. And there's like a lot more pressure on him right from the get-go. And his journey in the movie reflects that, you know, there's a lot less like fun and easygoingness to it, and a lot more, you know, self-inflicted pressure and loathing than we see between the two of them in An Unbearable Weight, where it's a put on, first of all. Like, you know, the reason they're writing the screenplay is because Nicolas Cage needs to hang around longer to help foil this presidential kidnapping plot. I don't know, you know, but
Genevieve, he's an international, we're talking about international gun running, and there's a right. candidate who would be unfavorable to his views, whose daughter is being kidnapped, so he will drop out.
This is all very important.
Yes.
Letting the more favorable candidate win.
Also, yeah. The CIA has the foggiest notion of what it's doing as far as actually surveilling people.
None of this matters.
Congratulations on retaining that, guys.
I think to circle back to what you're saying with the meta touches and the way, you know, they would comment on the action, both movies kind of comment on the action as they were going, I feel like in Adaptation is, as with much of it, it's very thought through and clever and ultimately kind of profound and reflects back on, makes you think about why we tell stories and how we tell stories, et cetera, et cetera. And I think in Unbearable Weight, it's cute. I mean, it's cute, you know, I mean, and I think that's kind of the difference between these two movies. I like Unbearable Weight quite a bit, but, you know, it's a good time, you know, whereas Adaptation is kind of, is something else entirely.
Yeah, it's the difference between something that is fun and something that you like actually admire. And I could see why the people behind Unbearable Weight would try to emulate Adaptation, because it's emulation worthy. It's so innovative. It's so creative. It's so constructed. But what they've come up with is something that's kind of fun.
It does feel a bit, just a little unworthy of Cage in the end. Like, because it is such a summary work, he's the real Nicolas Cage is 4 decades into his career. He has somebody wrote a book about him. There's a lot to reflect on, and you kind of hope that in its kind of zany way that the movie is going to be up to that challenge, and it just kind of barely sort of is, and it isn't as great as Cage. It's not up to that status, I guess. It doesn't hit it's AAA, it's not the major leagues.
I think maybe what symbolizes that more than anything else in Unbearable Weight is the sequence where Nick Cage is talking to Nikki and they start making out, and Nikki is yelling like, Nick Cage smooches good. And so it turns out that that was inserted into the film. It wasn't in the script, because Nick Cage thought it would be fun. And his justification for thinking it would be fun is, that's sort of kind of what we're doing here, right? It's like, it's sort of like I'm making out with myself. And so, you know, they actually did it in the movie. And like, that kind of seems to be the level of thought that went into a lot of this, is like, you know, it would be entertaining. Hey, you know what would be symbolic is if I made out with myself. And it's like, oh, okay, that's certainly an idea, but is there anything more to it than that? Oh, no, there really isn't. This was the whim of a moment and we went with it.
What a just a kind of a crappy final shot to, or final moment of this camera going up to that kind of LA skyline and then going back to that weird sort of Nicky moment from, was it a Nicky moment or a Cage moment?
Little audio inserted in. Yeah, that's, I think the final shot's fine until then, and then it's like, yeah, it's this one joke too many, one joke over the line. But you know, I think it's a fun movie, and it is Cage getting to be in on the joke and perhaps putting it to bed a little bit. Thinking of putting things to bed, I think it's time to put this podcast to bed and perhaps put myself to bed. We're recording this fairly late in the evening. If you want to watch Adaptation, which we highly recommend, it is streaming on HBO Max and rentable through the usual service. And it's also available on Blu-ray and DVD, both for purchase and from your local library. The Unbearable Weight of Massive Talent is in theaters now. That's it for this edition of the Next Picture Show, but we'll be back next week with a new pairing. Genevieve, you want to set us up for our next episodes, which are dropping on May 10th and May 17th?
In the last Marvel Cinematic Universe movie, Spider-Man No Way Home, Doctor Strange tried to work his magic to keep the public from knowing Spider-Man's true identity. The good news? He succeeded. The bad news, he cracked open the multiverse, allowing for a visitor from alternate realities to invade the MCU and create all sorts of chaos. Now, with the new film Doctor Strange in the Multiverse of Madness, the series has brought in the ultimate chaos agent and director Sam Raimi, whose hyperkinetic style made him a cult hero with the Evil Dead movies, and brought energy to his own Spider-Man series with Tobey Maguire. But Raimi also has an original Doctor Strange-like hero in his past. Inspired by old-school Universal monster movies, Raimi's 1990 film Darkman is about an unusually volatile superhero whose actions aren't always on the straight and narrow. Liam Neeson stars as a scientist whose experimental skin grafts come in handy after gangsters try to burn him alive, and he uses the grafts to disguise his appearance. The multiverse may not be opened in Darkman, but on our next set of episodes on Darkman and the new Doctor Strange, there will be plenty of madness.
For now, we welcome your feedback on Adaptation, The Unbearable Weight of Massive Talent, and anything else film-related you'd like to talk about. Email us at comments@nextpictureshow.net and come talk to us at Patreon, where you'll find feedback, letters, and discussion. Before we close out this week's episode, where can we find everyone these days? Tasha?
I am the film and streaming editor at Polygon.com. Boy, I have been writing a lot about everything everywhere all at once. I have been interviewing those filmmakers a lot. I've also been talking to Robert Eggers about The Northman. And I now know some things about penises on airplanes that I think you're going to be very, very happy to see. You can find that at Polygon.com under my byline. You can find me on Twitter at Tasha Robinson. And I also recently appeared on Pop Culture Happy Hour, one of our favorite podcasts of all time. Thanks to our former colleague, Stephen Thompson. There, I was talking with Glenn Weldon about Our Flag Means Death and my huge fandom for that series and many, many other people's huge fandom for that series. Scott?
Yeah, you can find me on Twitter at @Scott_Tobias. You can find my work in New York Times and Vulture and The Ringer, where I also did a big old thing on Robert Eggers, an essay though, nothing about airplane penises or anything like that. Sorry. And then, of course, along with our host, Keith Phipps, I have The Reveal, our newsletter. You can find that at thereveal.substack.com. I recently did a list of the 10 best rom-coms that you might want to check out.
Really? What possibly could have predicated that,
Scott?
I don't know.
I just was inspired, you know, just one of those random bits of inspiration. Genevieve?
I am the TV editor at vulture.com, and you can find me on Twitter at Genevieve Kosky. Keith, take us home.
You can find me on Twitter at kphipps3000, where I post my various writings and such. These include, of course, the Reveal, thereveal.substack.com, where you can find Scott and me. I recently launched a series that's going to take you all the way through the 80s, one quarter of each year at a time. And you can find my writing at places like GQ, The Ringer, Vulture, and TV Guide. And I have a book We might have mentioned that. It's called The Age of Cage. You get the whole Cage career up to and including at least a reference to The Unbearable Weight of Massive Talent, if not the film itself. We did not, you know, I had to close the book on the book before seeing this film. It is available wherever books are sold. You can stay updated on the Next Picture Show at nextpictureshow.net and on Twitter at nextpicturepod. Get bonus content and open discussion at patreon.com/nextpictureshow. And as always, we appreciate your rating and reviews on Apple Podcast or wherever you listen to the show. Thanks to Dan the Bake Jakes for his assistance producing this podcast. The Next Picture Show is proud to be part of the Film Spotting family of podcasts. Please tune in next time. Here's the number, call my agent. Bitch, I'm a national treasure. I make it rain in the desert. I got an octopus. Yep. I got a pyramid. Yep. You think I'm extra? I'm on some Nicolas Cage shit. Good call, baby doll. Nicolas.